I guess I'll just start off by saying that this is Tara Steinmeiser interviewing Bob Thonin on November 28th in Joyner Library. And I guess I'm just going to start off and ask you about your family, like what your life was like growing up, where you grew up, and what, how many brothers and sisters you have, and just if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Well, I was born in Florida in Pinellas County. Probably three or four people that year. There weren't too many people in the middle of Florida. My father was in the Army, and when he was discharged after World War II, he went to University of West Virginia. And then following that, he went to Fort Belvoir, and of course, family went with him. I had one brother, I think I was about five, I guess, when we got to Fort Belvoir, finally settled there. That's in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. one brother, and grew up in the 50s, and it was a real reflection of what Happy Days, more or less, is showing. The war was over, the rationing was over, the shortages were over. It was very good times. Everybody was in very high spirits. A lot of houses being built, a lot of people achieving what up to that point had been the dream. When I was in high school, I was a junior in high school when Kennedy was shot. And that seemed to just switch the whole world around. I mean, it was much the same as what's happened with the 911 stuff, like night and day. Went from a real innocent golden age, I guess, into a more realistic, aware of the things that are going on in the world. And that was much the same spirit that's out there now. The military was more or less respected. It was a good thing. It wasn't evil. It was a good thing. And there was, of course, the draft. And I had a choice of either waiting until I got drafted or just going ahead and joining them and trying to have some control over what direction I went in. And then after the military, I came back and went to college here in East Carolina. And by that time, the atmosphere hit. Switched in, and it was totally isolationist mood. You know, what the rest of the world did, nobody wanted to be bothered with. Just wanted to mess with stuff here. That process, that political process that took place, was very divisive. It was, people had very strong opinions one way or the other, and it was argumentative. It was very clashing. Well, when I came here, I was a business major. And the first job I had with the newspaper was as the business manager, and selling ads and stuff like that. I thought it was great. I'd go to school and make some money. During that year, I believe this was 69, I guess, during that year, the student body primarily got very upset over the conservative nature of the newspaper. It was very tightly controlled by the administration. Some degree of control by academic personnel. The faculty advisor was Ira Baker, Dr. Ira Baker in the journalism department. And he had a lot to say about what was going on. But even the faculty was overridden by the administration as far as what was determined to be in the best interest of the school. I was more or less a compromise, I guess you'd say, because I really didn't have the far left wing kind of background. I was in the military, so, but then I didn't have the far right wing background either. I was respectful of where they were coming from and so on. So the stipulation I put on it was that the newspaper would be open to all opinions. I'd take the job, I'd be the editor. I had no or very little limited experience in writing or so on and so forth, but it was more political than it was anything else.
Right. Well, how long had you worked at Fountain, East Carolina, before you were the editor?
About a year. It was that spring. The editor-in-chief actually left school because things got so intense, and he was a very gifted writer, a very gifted contributor to The Rebel and Literary Magazine and the yearbook and what have you. He was fantastic. But he just was overwhelmed by the politics of what was going on, and a military approach, I guess, best way to describe it, was about the only thing that the publications board seemed to think would put something together there. And they liked the idea that I felt my best approach would be to do everything I could to make sure that whatever the student opinion was, left, right, middle, up, down, you know, whatever, that we would make a provision for that. A lot of the material that had been written by the newspaper was getting a lot of flack about being too one-sided, it was too left-wing, it was too sympathetic with these political causes. There wasn't any other side of the question. And I found an ex-Marine that would come in and write conservative pieces. He was a very good writer and did a real good job. That helped maintain some degree of balance. And then too, John East was very active. He was a faculty member at the time. He was very active in campus politics and local politics. And so when he started getting involved, the newspaper focused on him because he was faculty member here at East Carolina. Again, the idea was try to focus attention on what's going on with the campus, the students, faculty, you know, what have you. And it went on pretty well for some time until it was the following year, and we had implemented a policy where if you wrote a letter to the editor and it was illegal, what you were saying was legal. In other words, there was no libel, there was no indication of a problem with the law, that if you limited it to 300 words and either indicated you didn't want it edited, in which case we'd leave it the way you sent it in, or were willing to accept simple editing, but you had that choice, then we would guarantee that the letter would be published. We would do whatever it took, you know, to give enough space. Well, it started out, you know, a reasonable number of letters, maybe half a page or so. It grew into several pages. Yeah. We were publishing page after page of letters to the editor. And for some reason, that clicked. People really got off on it. Well, the letter that caused such commotion was in compliance with these standards. When we set the standards up, we also hired an attorney, put an attorney on retainer for the question of, well, if we do run across stuff like this, what are we going to do? Well, let's at least have some legal advice. And he was Jerry Paul, was his man's name. He was an activist attorney, and was willing to take the job for little or nothing. I'm not sure we even ever paid him anything. You know, he was an advisor, I guess. Anyhow, when this letter came in, I knew there was a problem with it. I had no idea there would be as big of a problem with it as there was. So we checked it with the attorney, and the attorney said, no, this is not illegal. There's no problem with it. And we had been running some material that was of off-color, is I guess the best way to describe it. I personally find off-color stuff offensive. But then, again, I'm not imposing my, I'm trying to make a, well, we called it the forum, you know, and it was, that was the idea. If it was legal, you could say whatever you wanted to, and we'd support your ability to say it. That policy made for a lot of popularity for the newspaper. It was left-wing elected, right-wing elected, administration elected, even. Dr. Jenkins, I was in his office probably once a week, and part of my argument with Dr. Jenkins was this blow steam off. It lets people express themselves without having to throw rocks and stuff like that, which he seemed to get the drift of and had no problem with it. He had also, about 2 years before this, he'd also been served with an arrest warrant. Or at least that's the story he told me, that they had a copy of Lenny Bruce's book for sale in the student bookstore. And if you know Lenny Bruce, I mean, every other word is a cuss word from Lenny Bruce. And one of the faculty members, and now this, I'm not sure about it, but this is what he told me, was that one of the faculty members went down and swore out a arrest warrant against him for selling obscene material on campus.
Oh, goodness.
And so he sympathized with the position I was in and had no problem with it at that time.
So would you say that Jenkins was like a, I mean, would you say that he was like a strong backer of the newspaper, or he sort of?
No, I can't say he was a strong backer. He was tolerant because I think he felt it would be in the best interest of the school for this procedure to be followed. We had, the publications board had put together a formal package, you know, and this was submitted and had been approved, at, as was the case with virtually everything, by the administration at that time. I can't say he was a strong supporter because he was also running for governor, and he was having to take a lot of political considerations into account, and students were not very well regarded in Eastern North Carolina at the time. The local population was very conservative, very, I'm not going to say unenlightened, but they had strong opinions about what was right and what was wrong, and didn't want to be challenged. And what was going on was a definite challenge all the way across the board. So, you know, this was just one minor facet, you know, symbolic more than anything else. Then the folderol with publication of the letter, it immediately resulted in the writer of the letter's suspension or expulsion, and my expulsion, which I was a little surprised about. I found out later that the primary motivation for that came from Robert Morgan, who at the time was North Carolina's Attorney General, and he was on the board of directors, and I think he was a chairman of the board of directors. I'm not sure about that. The board of trustees. I'm sorry. And he, in effect, overrode Dr. Jenkins, and Dr. Jenkins was very quickly moved out of the picture as far as this situation is concerned. And I believe he was still running for governor at the time, Dr. Jenkins. the court case took about 4 years, I guess, 4 or 5 years before it was finally settled. I was able to go into federal court, get a temporary restraining order so that I could get back in school, myself and the writer. The local ACLU chapter, which I was on the board of directors of, decided to take the case and pursued it as a freedom of speech case. And it didn't take long. It was maybe 10 days or 2 weeks, I guess, by the time all the paperwork was done and everything, and I was officially back in school. But by that time, finals were over. I had flunked all my classes because of non-attendance and so on and so forth. So I rapidly became in academic trouble and kind of burrowed down to try to manage to get through college. Later on, when the court case was finally settled and everything, the grades were adjusted, and I wound up with a decent academic average, but that didn't help me much as far as getting a job or so on and so forth. I had a wife and about a one-year-old daughter when I finally graduated, and realizing the reality of life and so on, I knew that Eastern North Carolina was not where I was going to be able to find a decent living. I had been offered an internship at the Savannah Morning Herald, I believe that's the name of the place, down in Georgia. And when this all blew up, of course, it was withdrawn. And Robert Morgan had put the word out that this was a persona non grata. You don't want to be involved with him. Mm-hmm. So I, during the years all this was going on, I had had several jobs. I'd worked as a writer, photographer, editor of a couple of dailies. I did have an internship at Harper's Magazine. They didn't seem to feel there was any problem with all this, and so on. But It just, this was after, not long after Woodward and Bernstein, and people were paying to get journalism jobs, in effect. You know, they would do anything.
Right.
It was very glamorous, it was very, and your run-of-the-mill, just regulation kind of journals got kind of pushed out of the ballpark. It was taken over. That journalism and the news media in general has been taken over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what force is behind it, but somebody's behind it. It's not the same thing that it was before. For instance, I've got a degree in English, which is what they gave you as far as journalism was concerned back then, which is an academic program. And as I understand it, journalism has been transferred out of the academic area into advertising, or basically
mm-hmm.
what advertising would be, and that's more vocation. I can see the whys and wherefores, but I miss the idea that journalism is an academic kind of profession
mm-hmm.
rather than a salesman.
Right.
You know, it just
yeah.
that gripes me.
I just want to sort of go back to some of the stuff after the letter was published. Did you find that students on campus, like, was it a well-known thing on campus about this?
Oh yeah, there was. It was amazing. I was overwhelmed by the amount of support the students and the faculty came in with. It was obvious, first of all, that I wasn't trying to advocate everybody run around and cuss everybody.
Right.
And second of all, it was obvious that everybody was getting a pretty decent shot at having what they want said and published and people reading it. So we had a variety of different things that went on. They had, when the trial itself was taking place, and I'm not sure what I was convicted of, but I was convicted of something. They had a demonstration, and they went to the extent, I didn't know all this was going on, they went to the extent of building a coffin, a full-size coffin, and they had pallbearers and everything all dressed up, and here they come marching in with this coffin to symbolize the death of freedom of speech. So it was a very high price to pay as far as the involvement that I had in it, but I wouldn't trade it, you know, it was the kind of thing that I felt like I was privileged to be in the right place at the right time to take a stand that's obvious, you know, just happened that way. So I feel grateful that, you know, whatever forces there be put it together that way. It's a very high price, but it's a very good experience.
Sure. Well, is there a specific thing that you feel that you kind of took away from the whole experience, or it was just an overall?
Reassurance that it often takes a lot longer than you might think, but the American people, they have a very good track record at recognizing BS
mm-hmm.
and being able to come to considered intelligent decisions as a body of people. That I think is something that's very unique with the American experience, and primarily because there is not supposed to be any one politically correct position, that every day it's a new situation, and the best we can do with finding an answer or the answer today would be yesterday's question, because today there's going to be a whole new bunch of questions. So this process of the responsibility for this being on everybody, all members of the society, to come to some conclusions that benefit the entire society as them being part of it. A lot of times we've gotten off on sidetracks over here where it's almost a religious fervor kind of thing. We've got to make sure that this happens, or we've got to make sure that that happens. And yet, after the heat of the fire calms down a little bit, the people people generally get it. And I thought that was, that's something that I've felt for 30 years now, and it's been something that I've leaned on as, you know, when I see things going on that I'm concerned about, or you know, it just weirds me out somehow or another, and I'm going, well, you know, if you just wait long enough, that society will probably figure out a way of dealing with this without stomping on somebody.
And I was going to ask, I guess it's kind of, you already answered this sort of, but if you had the situation to do all over again, would you have, do you think you would have made different decisions? Or?
I would have taken a much deeper breath, but I'd do it again.
You would. let's see what else I wanted to ask you. So what, the after the court case and everything, what was the final outcome, like, after the, all the...
The school was ordered to put me back in school. They did that under temporary restraining order. So I was able, from when the restraining order was issued, from that point on, I was all right. But it was that which took place before, where all the grades were messed up and so on. And the final resolution was a permanent, you have to let him back and have to adjust the grades so that they reflect the circumstance. And I think I was awarded $1. I think that's what we sued him for. In order to sue, you have to sue for something. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure people realized I wasn't doing this to win the American lottery. You know, this was a principal thing, not a money-generating action.
Sure. So you were talking about Robert Morgan, was that his name? So he was really the main driving force?
Well, now that's what I've been told. See, I didn't know any of all this while it was going on. But in the years that passed, that's what I've heard from various sources. And he took a very personal interest in it. He was here on campus. He was involved in the trial and testified as the president of the, president of the trustees, board of trustees. And I can't argue that. You know, I don't find what he or Dr. Jenkins or any of the other people were involved in to have been negative or, I don't think they were trying to do anything to the newspaper, to me, or to anybody else. They felt they were right. At that time, we had a philosophy, I guess, of in loco parentis, which meant that the school was supposed to act in the place of parents. Well, we also were drafting men at 18, and we were also not letting them drink or vote until they were 21. Well, all of that stuff was being adjusted. There for a while, you could vote and drink at 18. You were considered to be an adult during that period anyway, when you turned 18. We progressed some from that, but the argument again was, if you're going to have the responsibilities, you ought to have the rights. So they were on the crux of the old with the transition into the new. And their system was being challenged, and the way they were operating was being challenged. It wasn't personal. I wasn't going out to make it be that way, but that's what it was. By the same token, I don't think it was personal from their perspective. I don't think they were going out to make it be that way. They were in that time, that place, and this is how it worked. And so I was able to maintain good relations, well, not with Robert Morgan, but with Dr. Jenkins and various other members of the administration, Dean Mallory, the Dean Men, and a variety of other people were very much of the same bent, but it wasn't personal. You know, it wasn't a adversarial kind of thing.
Okay. And I was also going to talk a little bit about the actual letter. I understand it was written by Bill Schell, and I just was kind of wondering, I didn't know if you knew him personally before then.
Not before it came in to the newspaper. Not until after it was published, actually. We confirmed his name and address, I believe. We confirmed all of the writers. Having it be a student newspaper, we did limit it to either students, faculty, or administrators. So, and we had to have, and we would put anonymous or something like that if they wanted their names withheld, But we had to be sure that they were, in fact, who they said they were before we would publish it. So that was one of the stipulations. So I don't believe I checked on it. I may have, but I don't recall it. But it was checked that he was, in fact, the one who wrote this letter, and he was willing to stand up for it if we published it. And at that point, then, we took it to the lawyer.
I guess, well, you were talking about earlier how a lot of the accounts that are like in the archives now and stuff aren't exactly correct. Can you kind of like...
There was a lot of press that would adjust things, that would, even a retrospective that one of the students here did, he went back and looked at some of the local press rather than the accounts that the newspaper published, for instance, or Associated Press or Newswires, that sort of thing. But if they looked at the Daily Reflector, say, or if they looked at some of the other stuff, they got inaccurate information. The archivist here at the library has gone back in and went back to the primary documents, and instead of relying on what somebody said, and put together a marvelously accurate picture of it. It's a very impressive piece of work that she's done. It's hard to point out specific places where the differences are. But what she's indicated she'd like to do is to leave it there and then to have the primary information also, so there's some other pages that have been put up, and then let people see how this is what happened, this is what a lot of people heard happened. So, you know, kind of give a little more flavor to it.
Okay, that's interesting. So you finished up your degree at ECU, and did you live in Greenville after that for a long time? Or did you
As soon as I got the degree, I wound up going back to work for the Army as a civilian, and stayed there until I retired.
Okay, and then you moved back. I thought it was pretty interesting that that now you're involved in the Friends of Joyner Library. Could you just sort of talk about why you decided to get involved with that?
Well, I'm retired and want to be still involved. I miss the toys. I miss playing. I've been busted up a couple of times, and so I can't really do enough to be paid for it, but I can do volunteer work. And I can't think of a better thing to do volunteer work than join a library. One of the first things that happened to me when I got to campus after leaving the service, and I was in Vietnam 3 days before I reported to class. I mean, it was a very abrupt transition. And I was a little older than most of the other students, so that was a little difficult to deal with. I had to learn how to be a student. Well, one of the learning processes was when I came into the library right after I got here. It couldn't have been more than a few days. I mean, I've always loved libraries. I don't know when this actually happened, but it was very soon after I got here. And I came into the library, and I went to the card catalog, and put together a bunch of different things, and then I started looking for how you got to the stacks. I was used to, living in Northern Virginia, I was used to going to the Library of Congress, where you can just go in and sit down, you can read, you know, and so on. Well, they didn't do it here that way. You had closed stacks, you had to fill out forms, and then a runner would go into the stacks. They'd find your books, and a half hour later or so, they'd come back. Well, I wanted to spend that half an hour up in the stacks. I was giving the lady at the counter a hard time. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. She was a very sweet lady, and I was very upset. And I was not a very pleasant person, I don't think. Anyhow, Wendell Smiley, who was the director of the library at the time, head librarian or whatever the title is, and he was off to the side. Of course, I didn't know that he was who he is. You know, he was just somebody standing off to the side, but he heard this, and he came up behind me, and I looked around, and he said, "Is there a problem here?" And I said, "Well, something to the effect of, I want to play with the books. Let me play with the books. And he said, well, I've been listening to you, and I think I've got a solution for you. So he took me around and took me back into the back and filled out this form, so on and so forth, and he took me up to the third or fourth floor somewhere and took me back to a carrel. He said, here's your carrel. He said, you can use this, you can wander around the stacks all you want to, you can do whatever research you want to. Don't give my lady a hard time trying to ask anymore. So from that point on, the library was first on my list.
I guess I'm sorry to keep skipping around on you, but
when
you were talking about being in Vietnam, and I remember I read the letter that Bill Shell printed, and I know that he made some references to stuff that happened in Vietnam, and I was just wondering if that maybe that struck a chord with you, or if
I was very upset over a lot of the stuff. In fact, I was more upset with the content of Bill Shell's letter than I think most people were with his salutation. And it's primarily because although there were isolated instances of this and that, whatever other kind of problems you want to put on activity in war, I was astonished at how restrained and disciplined I and all the people I ran across while I was over there were. And so if I'd had a problem, I would have not published the letter because of what it was implying.
Sure.
But at the same time, you don't resolve that by covering it up or throwing it away or ignoring it. The only way you can do it is bring it on down, put it on the middle of the stage, everybody take a look at it and see what we got going here. That's one of the objections I have to all this emphasis on restricting hate speech. One person's hate speech might not be somebody else's hate speech. And I take the attitude that it's not freedom of speech that I'm arguing for, it's freedom of hearing. Because if you don't have freedom of speech, you're not going to hear it. If you don't hear it, that don't mean it's not there. It's just underground, it's undercover, it's hidden, it's dark, it's allowed to fester them. If you've got something that is in fact that evil, or you think it's that evil, my feeling is that you should bring it out and put it on the stage in the sunlight. Let everybody take a real good look at it and respect their ability to recognize what is. You don't cover it up.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I guess I don't really have anything else that I wanted to ask you. I think you pretty much covered it, but really good interview for me. I guess I'm just looking at these real quick. I guess that's pretty much all I wanted to ask you then.
It's a real pleasure. I've enjoyed the element of having done something I feel proud of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times there's a lot of things you do that just either a waste of time or you just rather not even talk about. This one I'll talk about anytime.
Yeah, I've just been really interested to hear about this because I know one of the things that we've struggled with at the paper is that we feel that like student interest is like down. We don't feel like anybody cares about it, and like the stories that people are covering are just like, there's a lot of us felt like the paper now is like just too conservative. Like we just do the, oh, so-and-so got promoted to this new faculty position, which is like, yeah, you need to like cover it, but at the same time, so it's really cool for me to hear about like students like writing in and like being proactive, because a lot of time, you know, ECU gets flack for being like, we're not politically active, like they're over at Carolina, and you know.
It's not that much different, Carolina. Don't let them kid you.
Yeah. But you always see the picture of the Carolina students outside with like naked because they're protesting sweatshop labor, and over here there's not, you know, there's not a lot of stuff going on. And that was one of the things that we'd sit around our editorial board meetings and like try and think of things that like would get people interested. And it seems sort of now that like there's some interest but not a lot. And you know, it's one thing that I know that they're struggling with is just trying to get.
In a lot of ways, it's very similar to what it was in the maybe mid-60s. There's a pretty good idea that that which is a construction of society is in pretty good shape, that we're doing a lot of things right and don't want to rock the boat. Well, that was pretty much the attitude in the late 50s and early 60s. You know, we're doing something right here. Let's not mess it up. Well, sometimes the world doesn't let you go that way. So what tomorrow is going to bring, we may have another 60s.
Yeah, I thought also when you were talking in the beginning about how your 50s and then Kennedy and the change everything and relating it to the September 11th thing, I thought that was like a really interesting comparison, because it's true. It seems like things that we were worried about, you know, a couple months ago just don't hold any water. Like, you're not hearing anything about Gary Condit or, you know, any of that
right.
sort of stuff now that we're also like interested in. It just doesn't seem to have a place.
Bears at the door seem to change your attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely a bear at the door right now.
That's true. That's true. Well, I guess that's it then. But just